You are your own hero. You are your own leader. You are your own master. And that is a big one, because we idolize so many people, and we want to be them. We want to be someone else. And in doing that, you lose all the potential of who you are. You mimic. You be them. You are them. You become them. And you lose you. And we look up to so many people in this world who will let us down. We're humans. I'm going to let you down. You're going to let somebody down. If you put them on a pedestal, you then lose time when that person comes up and lets you down. You must hold yourself accountable, and being your own hero, that's what that does. You make yourself so totally accountable for who you are. You focus on you and only on you to become the best person you could be for others. Because we leave a lot on the table not searching who we are. And then therefore, you die not knowing your greatest potential. The biggest one I would say is never pick the easy road. Never. Never. And it always goes back to kind of that, the hero mentality. Never pick the easy road. Ever in your life. That is the one road that is doom. It is doom. If you want something like 6-minute abs, all these different things, if you want it so fast, you may achieve what you wanted, but you want the permanent fix. The permanent fix comes from the hard road. The hard road gives you permanent results. The easy road gives you the quick fix. You will go back to where you started on the easy route. That hard route is so permanent that it ends up callousing you everywhere. Everywhere.
You keep a six pack forever.
You keep it. You keep it. Because you know the work that goes into it.
Yeah.
And the last one is, when you get to where you want to go in life, when you finally get there, you finally reach that point, and you're there, and you're happy as hell, realize this. You're not there yet. When you get that feeling that you arrived, be afraid. Be truly afraid. Because now you start to do this.
Slowly die.
Slowly die. Either you're getting better or you're getting worse. You're not staying the same. So when you get to where you think the journey is ended, and you're sitting back and you're like, I arrived. I'm on Mount Everest. I climbed 29,029.
Yeah.
The best thing to do is fall back down that damn mountain as fast as you can and start climbing.
Find the next climb.
Find the next climb.
Yeah.
These are the facts, and they are undisputed. Your problems and your past aren't on anybody else's agenda. Not really. You may have a few people in your inner circle who care about what you're going through, but for the most part, no one gives a shit because they're dealing with their own issues and focused on their own lives. I learned that the hard way. On our drive from Buffalo to 117 South McGuire Street in Brazil, Indiana, when I was 8 years old, I assumed I was going to walk into the biggest pity party of all time. I expected balloons, cake, ice cream, and big warm hugs. Instead, it was as if all the pain and terror never happened. Sergeant Jack didn't deal in pity. He was out to harden my shell. And that's exactly what he did. Pity is a soothing balm that turns toxic. At first, when your family and friends commiserate with you and validate the reasons you have for grumbling about your circumstances, it lands like sympathy. But the more comfort pity brings you, the more external validation you'll crave, and the less independent you will become, which will make it that much more difficult for you to gain any traction in life. That's the vicious cycle of pity. It saps self-esteem and inner strength, which makes it harder to succeed. And with each subsequent failure, you will be more tempted to pity yourself. Look, I get it. Life isn't fair or easy. A lot of us are doing a job that we don't want to do. We feel we are above the tasks coming our way, and that the world or God or the fates have sentenced us to live in a box we do not belong in. When I was a night shift security guard at a local hospital, I felt that work was beneath me. So I showed up every night with a voice in my head screaming, I don't want to be here. And that infected everything about my life. I ate my feelings, blew up, and slipped into a deep depression. I wanted a different life, but my shitty attitude made it impossible to create one. Every minute you spend feeling sorry for yourself is another minute not getting better, another morning you miss at the gym, another evening wasted without studying, another day burned when you didn't make any progress toward your dreams, ambitions, and deepest desires, the ones you've had in your head and heart your entire life. The only thing that ever matters is the present moment. Yet too many people let their depression or regret hijack their day. They let their feelings about the past hijack their lives. Perhaps their fiancé left them at the altar, or they got fired without cause. Guess what? One day, they will pan back and realize that nobody fucking cared about any of that but them. I don't care what you've been through. I can feel bad for you. I can have sympathy for you, but my sympathy won't get you anywhere. When I was a young, damaged kid, feeling sorry for myself didn't help me. What helped was cleaning those white walls right the first time. We cannot get time back, so we must be minute hoarders. The earlier I get up, the more I do. The less time I stay in pity party feel sorry for myself land, the stronger I become and the more daylight I see between me and everyone else. When you separate yourself from the pack by cultivating the values and priorities that lead to greatness, mountains of adversity and hardship become speed bumps, and that makes it easier to adapt to the road ahead and build the new life or sense of self you crave. When I went to live with Sergeant Jack, I was forced to adapt extremely fast. Everyone was hard on me my whole life, but I came out of all that with lessons learned that stuck with me. Those who learn to adapt survive and thrive. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Get strategic. Attack the problem. When you adapt, you will begin to see everything that comes your way as a stepping stone on your progression toward a higher plane. High-paying, esteemed jobs are generally not entry-level. You have to start somewhere, but most people see the thankless tasks that must be completed in order to advance as burdens instead of opportunities. That makes it impossible for them to learn. You've got to find the lesson in every shitty task or low-wage job. That requires humility. I wasn't humble enough to appreciate my experience in security, so my attitude was foul as fuck. I thought I deserved much better, oblivious to the fact that almost everybody starts at the bottom, and from there, it's attitude and action that determine the future. Humility is the antidote to self-pity. It keeps you rooted in reality and your emotions in check. I'm not suggesting you should be satisfied with an entry-level job. I'm never satisfied, but you must appreciate what you have while staying hungry enough to learn everything you can. You need to learn to wash the dishes, flip the burgers, sweat over the deep fryer, sweep up the job site, work in the mailroom, and answer the phones. That's how you build proficiency. It's important to learn every aspect of any business before you move up. You can't rise if you're weighed down by bitterness and entitlement. Humility hardens your spine and encourages you to stand tall, secure in yourself, no matter what anyone else thinks. And that has tremendous value.
Right now, a lot of you right now can be motivated as hell, go out of here and be like, yeah, I'm motivated. But you said you're right. Without being driven or obsessed, this motivation fades. And motivation is at the all-time high when your bills are paid, when your wife or husband is good, when everything is good, you're motivated. It's that person when all hell breaks loose and everything falls apart that says, I still gotta get it in. And how you get to that point in life, what I figured out, it's so noisy right now. This world is so noisy. We all walk around with these phones, computers. The world is so fast. We're not able to think. The most powerful weapon in the world, we walk around with it. It's our mind, it's our brain. You have to be able to go into a very dark place in your mind and figure who you are. Go back to what you want to do. What's your purpose? We can't figure our purpose out or why we're here or why we're even born or whatever because it's so loud in our mind. We don't have any quiet time with ourselves to sit back and say, what do I really want? There's so many different dialogues in our head that we can't think. So my biggest thing is you have to be alone in a very dark place in your mind to think about what is important to you.
And so, kind of piggyback off that, you've spent a lot of time alone. What is something that you learned about yourself through your process or your journey?
I learned I was leaving a lot on the table, and that's what scares me the most. I'm good now, but what haunts me is that at 24 years old, I was 300 pounds, and if I didn't make a right turn, if I decided to just give in to the feelings I had, I would have died a 300 or 400 pound man working some minimum wage job in my casket, never knowing that I was this guy. And what fear, so I believe in God. And what scares me the most is I believe that God, in my own mind, I'm a big visualization person. So what keeps me going is like visualizing. It's not true, but it helps me. I believe that God had this big chart in heaven. And when you get there, if you earn your right to get there in heaven, and you get there, let's say I walked up at 300 pounds. And God says, hey man, great job, you made it to heaven. And he rips this page down from Brian Underwood. And now it says David Goggins' chart. He rips it down, throws that paper to the side. And he says, look at this. And I'm reading it. I go, what is this? He goes, how much do you weigh? 300 pounds. What did you do? I was a pest control guy for 40 years. He says, this is what you were supposed to be. You know what I'm saying? A 185-pound person. Be able to run 205 miles. Break the pull-up record. Motivate people. Energize people. Make them driven. Make them passionate. Make them find more. So am I in heaven or in hell? That's what motivates me. It scares me also. Because I believe that we are all leaving a lot on the table. And now when I go to heaven, what I want God to look at me and say is, as you were living, I'm the all-knowing man. I had to get a damn marker out and write more as you were living. You see what I'm saying? I want to impress him. That's what I'm here for. I want to do the impossible.
I once heard a story about a master sergeant in the Army named William Crawford that exemplifies the power of humility. He retired in 1967 and took a job as a janitor at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. The cadets he cleaned up after paid him little mind, in part because he was reportedly painfully shy, but also because these cadets were elite students on an officer track, and Master Sergeant Crawford was just a janitor, or so they thought. They had no clue that he was also a war hero. In September 1943, the 36th Infantry Division was getting blitzed by German machine gun fire and mortars during a pivotal World War II battle for a piece of Italian real estate known as Hill 424. The Americans were pinned down with no escape route until Crawford spied three machine gun nests and crawled beneath rivers of bullets to toss a grenade into each of them. His bravery saved lives and allowed his company to advance to safe ground. And after the third direct hit, the Germans abandoned Hill 424, but not before they took Crawford prisoner. Presumed to be killed in action, tales of his heroism spread among infantrymen and traveled up the chain of command. In 1944, he was awarded the Medal of Honor, the highest decoration in the U.S. military. Because everyone thought he was dead, his father accepted the medal on his behalf. Later that same year, he was found in a liberated POW camp, oblivious to the hype surrounding his name. In 1976, an Academy cadet and his roommate read about that battle and connected the dots. Their humble janitor had won the Medal of Honor. Can you imagine what went through their heads? The Medal of Honor speaks to everything a military person reveres, not the medal itself, but the courage and selflessness inside the human being who earned that medal. Those students wanted to be him, and there he was, mopping their floors and cleaning their bathrooms every day. Master Sergeant Crawford was a walking lesson in self-esteem, courage, character, and especially humility. The way I see it, Master Sergeant William Crawford had figured it the fuck out. The Medal of Honor didn't change him. He rose to prominence by staying humble and risking his own life to save others and retired into the service of others. It was never about him. And that gave him strength. People who feel sorry for themselves are obsessed with their own problems and their own fate. Is that really much different than the greedy and egotistical people who want to feel better than everybody else? The higher I climb in my life, the more I realize how much I need to mop that floor. Because that's where all the knowledge is. There is no grit at the top, no tests of resolve and steak dinners, five-star hotels, or spa treatments. Once you make it in this world, you have to free fall back to the bottom in some way to keep learning and growing. I call this trained humility. It's a shedding of your skin that allows you to take on a mission that no one else can see and do whatever needs to be done next. Trained humility is service, but also strength. Because when you are humble enough to remember that you'll never know it all, each lesson you learn only makes you hungrier to learn more, and that will put you on a path that guarantees you will grow all the way to the grave. Continued growth only comes when you are willing to be humble.
I talk about my book, Open-Mindedness. What separates me from a lot of people is they go into a daunting task, and the task is overwhelming. Like, when I heard the pull-up record was 4,020 pull-ups, and I was talking about breaking this record, people are like, oh my God. I went right to a pen and paper. They go, what are you doing? I'm doing the math, man. What are you talking about? I'm open-minded to the fact that, okay, if I do 5 pull-ups in a minute for so many hours, I can get so many pull-ups in. How much time do I have to rest? I was breaking the math down. You have to be open-minded to the possibilities that I can do this. Once you shut your mind down to the possibility that it can be achieved, there's no way it can happen. So that's why my eyes and my body light up about things, because I know that if you're in a fight, you have to attack. You have to keep attacking. The enemy has to know he is not going to give up. You must break the soul of whatever the fuck is in front of you. That's what I realized. I was never breaking the soul of anything in front of me. So that's why I came up with a thing called Taking Souls in my book. I started to devise ways to break a soul of a human being, of an object, of whatever's in front of me. If you keep on attacking something, nothing wants to stand in front of anything that is relentless. Nothing.
The Taking Soul part of the book is really interesting because you talked about like the mind shift that you had when you were in Buds.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's an intense part of the book.
That's when a lot of stuff started clicking, man. I started watching those instructors on the side. Because, you know, there's three shifts. There's 8 instructors, 3 shifts. Because, you know, the guys going through Hell Week, they're up all day and all night for 130 hours. This is the promised land of mental hardening for me. I love this place. And you have the instructors who you know, they've been there, done that. Now they're instructing you. So they do their 8-hour shift. They have their parkas on. It's usually cold coffee, drinking their coffee. And they're beating the crap out of us. And when I started realizing, I started playing mind games. And I was like, you know what? I bet these fuckers are looking at us, judging themselves about when they were going through Hell Week. About, let me see, I'm looking at Goggins right now. I was better than him. I was better than that guy. I was better than that fucker over there. And I was like, okay. You're going to judge me, right? All right. So this is what I'm going to do to you. So what I started doing was I got my boat crew. Boat crew 2. It's in the book. It's a great, great story. I said, come here, guys.
You can't break boat crew 2.
You can't break boat crew 2. So it's Wednesday, and everybody's broken. Everybody's beat up, man. And like this is when you start moving like a robot. Everybody's like just kind of just trying to get through Hell Week now, and your energy's zapped. And they know Wednesday's like that over the hump.
I love that you talked about that in the book too, that they put it in your head that Wednesday you're going
to
be tired.
Oh yeah, and that's another thing. They tell you how you're supposed to feel, so you are feeling that way. I was like, don't let these motherfuckers tell you how you're supposed to feel. No, it's day one, motherfucker. This is hour one. So I was getting my boat crew all jacked up. I said, we're going to take these motherfuckers' souls. So when they had us doing this simple thing that guys are struggling with, Boat Crew 2 was just launching the fucking boat in here, yelling, yeah, you can't fucking hurt us. Can't hurt Boat Crew 2. And I looked on the instructors' faces, and it looked like someone had just fucked with their soul. And I looked at my guys in my boat crew, and I said, hey, guess what? Those motherfuckers aren't fucking tonight. We own space in their fucking head. We own space. They're going to think about us tonight. They could think about how the
You're
fuck.
Killing boners.
That's right. How on Wednesday are these guys doing this?
And screaming out, you can't hurt Boku too.
We were bringing the fight.
We were attacking. So when you keep on doing that, guess what people start doing? I ain't fucking with these guys no more. So Bro Crew 2 got a lot more sleep. Bro Crew 2 just became that Bro Crew, like, hey, because we just kept charging and we start fueling off of that. We start fueling off the fact that, man, it takes 1 second of energy to steal everybody's. And then you have all the energy you need. That's all you need. You need to look at someone's eyes. You know how it is when you fight somebody and you broke that motherfucker. He's like, oh God, man, I don't want to go back to the next round. And you feel like, my God, I can fight all day. I can fight all day long. That's what taking souls is. But you have to have the will, the heart, the courage to go that distance when you're exactly jacked up. You have nothing left to give, and give more.